How is it that we're going to be able to deal with all of the folks who are needing and who are without? I guess that's been a question that has been asked a number of times, especially in recent years in Western countries. We think about nations that have become quite affluent, like the United States has. And so the question comes, what are we going to do about that? And so politically, there's been a number of suggestions. And some of you have lived through a number of those suggestions, haven't you? You might, some of you as children, have remembered the things that went on just after the Great Depression, where things were going to be done to end poverty. Some of you, more of you, will remember in the 1960s when the war on poverty, as it was called, began, and we were going to annihilate poverty in the United States. And yet, where are we? We're still a nation that's quite affluent, but still has a number of poor people living here. Now, in the midst of all of these political discussions, oftentimes Jesus will be quoted. And you'll hear a politician say this, "Well, the poor you have with you always." And so it's as if they are taking a phrase that Jesus uses and using it somewhat as social commentary to say, well, now here's the Lord himself, and he said, we're always going to have poor people with us, therefore we'll never solve the problem of poverty. Well, while that may be true, I don't believe that was the context in which Jesus offered it. And so this morning, what I'd like for us to do is to spend the first part of our lesson talking about the situation where Jesus brings that up, look at his motivation for saying it, and then pay particular attention to what the Bible says about how we deal with poverty and thus make the necessary applications to ourselves. But let's begin by the situation where a woman comes to Jesus very near the end of his life. And she takes this very costly ointment and she anoints his feet. Three of the Gospels tell us about this. So what I'd like for us to do is to look at what each of them have to say. They're going to be very similar, but each of them adds just a little bit to the storyline. So let's begin with Matthew chapter 26. Verse 6 begins, "Now when Jesus was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, a woman came up to him with an alabaster flask of very expensive ointment, and she poured it on his head as he reclined at the table. And when the disciples saw it, they were indignant, saying, 'Why this waste? For this could have been sold for a large sum and given to the poor.' But Jesus, aware of this, said to them, 'Why do you trouble the woman? For she has done a beautiful thing to me. For you always have the poor with you, but you will not always have me with you. In pouring this ointment on my body, she has done it to prepare me for burial. Truly I say to you, wherever the gospel is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has done will be told in memory of her.'" The Lord was right. We're talking about it this morning. Let's look at what Mark has to say about this. As we look to Mark chapter 14, while he was at Bethany in the house of Simon the leper, as he was reclining at the table, a woman came with an alabaster flask of ointment of pure nard, very costly, and broke the flask and poured it over his head. There were some who said to themselves indignantly, "Why has this ointment been wasted like that? For this ointment could have been sold for more than 300 denarii and given to the poor." And they scolded her. But Jesus said, "Leave her alone. Why do you trouble her? She has done a very beautiful thing to me. For you always have the poor with you, and whenever you want, you can do good for them. But you will not always have me. She has done what she could. She has anointed my body beforehand for burial. And truly I say to you, wherever the gospel is proclaimed in the whole world, what she has been done will be told in memory of her." Now, when we come to the Gospel of John, there are some different details that are given here. And so the question might be, is this the same story or not? Let's leave that question aside for now because we're going to see the same argument being made. Mary is identified here, as in Mary, Martha, and Lazarus. It says, "Mary therefore took a pound of expensive ointment made from pure nard and anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair. The house was filled with fragrance, the fragrance of the perfume. But Judas Iscariot, one of the disciples, who was about to betray him, said, "Why was this ointment not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor?" He said this not because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief and having charge of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. Jesus said, "Leave her alone so that she may keep it for the day of my burial. For the poor you have with you, always with you, but you do not always have me." Very similar in most of it, isn't it, to what we read in Matthew and Mark. Now, if you'll bear with me for one more reading, let's take these three and see what was said about what this woman did. The disciples said, Matthew tells us, when they saw it, they were indignant, saying, "Why this waste? This could have been sold for a large sum of money and given to the poor." There were some who said to themselves, indignantly, Mark tells us, "Why was this ointment wasted like this? For the ointment could have been sold for more than 300 denarii and given to the poor." And then John, "But Judas Iscariot, one of his disciples, who was about to betray him, said, 'Why was this ointment not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor?'" There's great emphasis on poverty here. The disciples say, "Look, what has been done here was a complete waste of money. Think about all the people who could have been helped. We add a little to that." They're thinking, "We could have fed them. We could have clothed them. This would have gone such a long way. Yet, this has been wasted." I want you to notice what Jesus does at this point. When Jesus says, "The poor you have with you always," he was quoting the Old Testament. Sometimes I think we don't really catch that in this because we're focusing on other things. But yet as we look at this statement, Deuteronomy chapter 15 and verse 11, Moses says, "For there will never cease to be poor in the land." In other words, what? "The poor you have with you always. Therefore I command you, you shall open wide your hand to your brother, to the needy and to the poor in your land." But it gets even more interesting than that. Because when we go back to Deuteronomy and we plug this into the context of what Moses stated, I want you to note how Moses began this discussion. He starts out by saying, "There will be no poor among you." And he ends it by saying what? "There will never cease to be poor among you." So is Moses disagreeing with himself? Does he start out and say, "Well, there's not going to be poor," but then he says there are going to be poor? Well, what fits in the middle is extremely important. He says, "For the Lord will bless you in the land that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance." He goes on to say, "If you will only strictly obey the voice of the Lord your God, being careful to do all this command that I command you today," he goes on. And he says, "If one of your brothers should become poor, if any of your towns within your land that the Lord is giving you," what? "You shall not harden your heart or shut your hand against your poor brother, but you shall open your hand to him and lend him sufficient for his needs." And then he goes on with a warning. "Take care, lest there be an unworthy thought in your heart, and you say the seventh year, the year of release, and your eye looks grudgingly on your poor brother, and you give him nothing, and he cry to the Lord against you, and you be guilty of sin. You shall give to him freely, and your heart shall not be grudging when you give to him, because for this the Lord your God will bless you in all your work and all that you undertake." What happens between those two emboldened statements? Moses explains how there will not be poor in the land. The way there would not be poor in the land is if all of Israel opened their hearts in times of need. That when they see a brother who is struggling, a brother who's fallen on hard times, they're there to help. And then what I believe may be somewhat of an indictment, Moses says, that's never going to happen. Because there will be people who will be begrudging. There will be people who will not give in times of need. So why then would Jesus quote this section? I don't know that I can answer that fully because the Lord Himself does not explain it yet. I think it is not beyond the pale of possibility that these disciples may have fallen into one of two things. It may have been that they're kind of late to the game in consideration of the poor. That there was really not a lot of concern before this point, that they had really not paid a lot of attention to these things. And so Jesus here is bringing their attention back to these words of Moses, where Moses is saying there wouldn't be poor if everybody would do what they're supposed to. I think it may also be that they're saying what they thought Jesus would want them to say. That Jesus himself would view this as a great waste of money. And here is this man who is always kind to the poor and mixes with the poor and is himself poor while he's on earth. And so it may very well be that they're trying to beat Jesus to the punch here and trying to outguess him. And then Jesus completely changes the game when he brings this to their attention. Whatever the case, Jesus says, you always have opportunity to do good for the poor. And that is a theme that runs throughout the entirety of the Bible. I want to show you that this morning. That when we think about God's relationship to the poor, in every section of the Bible, we are finding strong, strong language from God when he says you need to pay attention to the needs of those who do not have as much as you do, who have not been blessed like you do. That was certainly the case for Israel. And I am for sure not going to try to list every passage where God does this because it would take a long time. So let me just give you two illustrations. I give you this one because it fits in with a story we know very well from the book of Ruth. But here's the command behind that story coming from Leviticus 19. You shall not strip your vineyard bare, neither shall you gather the fallen grapes of your vineyard. You shall leave them for the poor and for the sojourner. I am the Lord your God. And when you reap the harvest of your land, you shall not reap your field right up to its edge, nor shall you gather the gleanings after your harvest. You shall leave them for the poor and for the sojourner. I am the Lord your God. You see, Boaz was obeying God. When he didn't cut the corners, now he had a couple of ulterior motives there with liking Ruth, but nonetheless, it was fulfillment of this command. God is saying, when I bless you, don't try to grab every grape and every piece of wheat and greedily hold on to that. You make sure you're sharing it with those who are in need. And then concerning the attitude toward those who are in need, he says, you shall not oppress a hired worker who is poor and needy, whether he is one of your brothers or one of the sojourners who are in your land within your towns. Do we not see that today? Strangers within in our own land who are taken advantage of often, and they're paid very low wages. God said to Israel, you better not do that. You better pay them what you're supposed to. And on these passages go. But let me take your attention now to the books of poetry. You may be like me and just absolutely overwhelmed when you run this in Psalms and Proverbs. I could not believe the number of passages dealing with that. Again, let me just give you a sampler here. In the book of Psalms, here's what the Lord says. All of my bones shall say, O Lord, who is like you, delivering the poor from him who is too strong for him, the poor and needy from him who robs him? The psalmist says, you look down on the poor. You take care of them. Add with that what we find, what hopefully we find in 41:1, blessed is the one who considers the poor. In the days of trouble, the Lord delivers him. Listen to that. The one who is taking care of the poor. Add to the Proverbs. Proverbs 14:21, whoever despises his neighbor is a sinner, but blessed is he who is generous to the poor. Whoever oppresses a poor man insults his maker, but he who is generous to the needy honors him. Whoever mocks the poor insults his maker. He who is glad at calamity will not go unpunished. Whoever is generous to the poor lends to the Lord, and he will repay him for his deeds. Whoever closes his ear to the cry of the poor will himself call out and not be answered. Listen to that. God says, if you do not care for those in need, my ear is closed to you. If you do not take care of those who are in calamity, calamity is going to befall you. And we can multiply that over and over within Psalms and Proverbs. But let's look at what the prophets have to say. Have you ever noticed how many times the prophets of Israel are warning about mistreating the poor? We think about what Isaiah says, the Lord will enter into judgment with the elders and princes of his people. It is you who have destroyed the vineyard. The spoil of the poor is in your houses. What do you mean by crushing my people? By grinding the face of the poor, declares the Lord. Woe to those who decree iniquitous decrees and the riders who keep riding oppression to turn aside the needy from justice and to rob the poor of my people of their right, that widows may be their spoil and that they may make the fatherless their prey. Tuck that verse back for just a minute. We'll be back. Think about what Jeremiah says. Also on your skirts is found the lifeblood of the guiltless poor. You did not find them breaking in, yet in spite of all these things, you say, I am innocent. We think about Ezekiel's words. The people of the land have practiced extortion and committed robbery. They have oppressed the poor and needy. They have extorted from the sojourner without justice. Let's add one more. Book of Amos, chapter 8. Hear this, you who trample on the needy and bring the poor of the land to an end, saying, when will the new moon be over that we may sell grain, and the Sabbath that we may offer wheat for sale? When we take all of these things and put them together, what's the Lord saying to his people? He says, I have very great expectations for you, that you are to show great care and great concern for those who are in need, because when you treat them well, you treat me well. Whoever lends, gives to the poor, lends to the Lord. But conversely, what does he say? A lack of concern shows a lack of appreciation for what I've done for you. And so as we consider these things, Israel was given very straightforward commands. You take care of those who are in need. Now, what could we do at this point? Well, we could say that's all Old Testament, isn't it? That was all talking about Israel, taking care of Israel and those who were living in their midst. And the real question then is, what does the New Testament say about caring for the poor? Well, God is not silent. God has laid this foundation of His expectations for His people in the Old Testament. And building on that, He lays down the expectations for people in the New. And certainly, as we think about the teachings of Jesus, shows concern, doesn't it? The poor you have with you always, you've got plenty of opportunity to take care of them. But think about as well when He says, the second greatest command, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. If you're in need, do you want somebody taking care of you? If you're hungry, do you want somebody helping you find something to eat? I think we know the answer to that. And so we consider that passage. We consider what he tells the rich young ruler. Here's a man who is having a lot of trouble with covetousness. And Jesus says, I tell you what, I'm going to give you the greatest words that somebody can hear on the face of this earth when I say, come and follow me. Come and be with me. But first, go sell everything you have and give to the poor. The young man didn't do it. He went away sorrowful. We think about the parable of the Good Samaritan with all of these applications and lessons. But one of them is, here is a man who sees someone in need. And when he sees someone in need, he does not cross to the other side of the road. Yet, he takes the time and he ministers to this person, and he takes them, puts them in someone else's care, pays the bill, says, I'll be back to take care of them, far above and beyond what was expected of them. What is Jesus showing us? That the obligation, maybe I should say it this way, the blessing that God gives of being able to help those who are in need is one that did not end when the book of Malachi closed. And thus you and I, as we look at our New Testaments, we come to the book of James, and James flat out lays it on the line, doesn't he? As he writes about what it really means to be spiritual, he says, religion that is pure and undefiled before God the Father is this, to visit widows and orphans in their affliction, and to keep oneself unstained from the world. Why does he choose orphans and widows? We'll go back to the Old Testament. Four groups I always call them God's special groups of the Old Testament. Orphans, widows, strangers, and the poor. And you remember the passage that we read there in the book of Isaiah where he talked about the impoverished widows and fatherless? That's where this is coming from. And so James says, if you want to talk about what it really means to be religious, what it really means to be spiritually minded, what that means is that you are going to take care of those who are in need. You're looking out for the welfare of others. You are loving your neighbor as yourself. And he follows that with an example. Here's a man who comes into the assembly and he's wearing shabby clothes and they treat him horribly. They say, look, you sit over here, you sit at my feet. James says, have you not then made distinctions among yourselves? You treat one guy horribly because he's poor. You treat another guy great because he's rich. You've become judges with evil thoughts. Listen, my beloved brothers. Has not God chosen those who are poor in this world to be rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom which He has promised to those who love Him? Paul would add, those of you who are rich in this present age, be generous. Be generous in good works. What's the message from cover to cover of the Bible? When there are those who are in need, do not shut up your hearts. When there are those who are not as fortunate as you, you be a blessing to them. Oftentimes, people will come up after a lesson and they'll say, you were preaching that straight to me this morning, weren't you? And my standard answer is, I always start here and whoever else can benefit, that's very good. And I assure you what I'm about to talk about now, I began at home. Because it's very easy to dodge what I believe is a very obvious responsibility that God has given to those who have been blessed. And we oftentimes do this by trying to somewhat soothe our consciences about it. But yet, how does that dodging typically take place? Oftentimes, it's with a very judgmental attitude, isn't it? Here's someone who is in need, and we say, well, you know, if he would just get a job, he wouldn't be poor. If he would just find somewhere to work, he wouldn't have to be out looking. Or we might say, well, if I give that person money, he's just going to spend it on liquor and drugs, and I'll be supporting his habit. So really, I'm doing him a favor by not giving it to him. All right, we'll be back to that in just a second. We pass judgment. We assign motive here. Or maybe instead of passing judgment, we pass the buck. And we say, well, look, you know, when I get my paycheck, I look at the gross and the net, and there's a huge difference. And a good deal of that money has been taken out by the government, and they're going to give it to people in need. And so really, I am giving to the poor. I mean, they're taking that money out. They're giving it to folks who need it. So I'm good there. Now, here's the one that stings a little bit personally. We make a very academic case about helping the poor. As local churches, we do not have the authority to become lending agencies to everybody who needs money. I fully agree with that statement. Nowhere in the New Testament do we have authority to pin this on the work of the church to become a benevolent agency for everybody in need. It's the work of the individual, just other individuals besides me. I've got too many things I'm paying for right now, but those who have the money, they need to be paying it. So it's academic acceptance of responsibility. Yet once again, passing the buck. Or maybe it's just passive resistance. Well, you know, if somebody will just tell me they need help, I'm glad to give. They've just got to let me know about it. Now let me ask you, how many of you are going to go up to someone and say, I'm in terrible need. Would you mind helping me out? There's a few, but not many will do that in this world. So what do we do? We look at all of these passages and we agree it's not the work of a local church. It's the work of an individual. God has assigned that. He said it's a sign of pure religion. Jesus wanted us to take care of the poor, but yet somehow we may be failing in that. So what do we do? Well, instead of dodging responsibility, maybe it's seizing it instead. This year has been devoted to the thought of putting others first. And I'm assuming when the elders decided on that, they weren't limiting that just to people of faith. But the idea of that as servants of God, we're putting the needs of everyone above our own. And so here is someone, maybe a Christian, but maybe not, who's in need of help. What do I do? When I was preparing for this sermon, I decided I wanted to find the first place in the New Testament where the word poor is mentioned. You know where that was? Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. How do you and I come to the point of being poor in spirit? It's realizing just how impoverished we are and how much we are dependent on God to provide what's needed. How do I become poor in spirit? It's by emptying out the pride. It's by emptying out the self-satisfaction that I desire to be able to put the needs of someone else above my own. So how then do I seize responsibility? Well, the first thing I've got to do is to overcome unfair judgment. I gave you two illustrations a minute ago. We may say, well, if that guy would just go out and get a job, he wouldn't be poor. Sometimes, is that the truth? Yes. Do I have an obligation to help someone who is fully capable of getting out and getting a job but is just too lazy to get one? No, I do not. How do I know that? Jesus said, if a man will not work, neither shall he eat. The other example I cited was, well, they'll just spend it on liquor and drugs. That is a concern. Because I'm going to tell you, there's a network of people who go around to churches begging money and pretty much documented, taketh in and use it in ways that are against the ways of God. Do I use that as an excuse? Here's what I do. If at all possible, I get to know the situation. I can't do that every time. But yet, if I can, I get to know the situation, and if there's somebody here who is just too lazy to work, maybe the help there is to help that guy realize what his laziness is doing to him. Is that helping the poor? Absolutely it is. Or if there's somebody maybe I don't know who I'm afraid is going to take this and use it for things that are not good, I can be very specific in my giving, can I? Meet me over here at the restaurant. Meet me at the gas station. Meet me at your doctor's office. Meet me at the pharmacy. Whatever it is, you meet me there. I'll pay your bill for you this time. That separates. Okay? There are people who may be out there who are trying to take advantage. Well, that kind of weeds them out. Those who are just simply trying to deceive. But here, if somebody's really in need, I've got the opportunity. So it's not overcoming judgment, because judgment is absolutely necessary, but it's overcoming this glossing judgment where everybody who's poor fits into that category. And I help those who I can help. And I trade that passive resistance for aggressive acceptance. If it's the work of the individual, I better put my individual to work, hadn't I? If I say, this is not the work of a local church, we can't burden the local church with being a benevolent agency to everybody who comes about, then I better be doing my responsibilities there. Now, does that mean that I can help everybody who comes along? With family obligations, we know that's not the case. But it does mean equipping ourselves where we can be helpful. Though I may not be able to help everybody, I may be able to help people get to the help that they need. As much as our government is bad-mouthed, one of the things that we do see is local, state, and national government has set up all kinds of ways of helping those who are in need. And it may be, as an individual, me helping that person, but what that means is I've got to take responsibility. I can't just simply say, well, you know, I don't know where you can get help. I don't know. Good luck on that. But making myself someone who is a good servant to others, who is putting others first in that. And may I add, we never allow this to be seasonal. It's interesting, isn't it? When do most benevolent agencies make their big pitch for funding? It's Christmas. Why? Because we're all filled with warmth and good cheer, right? Everybody's happy. We're willing to give. That should not typify a Christian. A Christian should have that warmth and happiness all year long. That whenever the opportunity presents itself, however I can find someone to help, that's exactly what I'm going to do. And I do that with very great zeal that is seen not only by me, but also by my children. I'm active in finding ways to help. I'm not waiting for somebody to come begging me for help to help them. I'm looking for those opportunities when I can. I say this next statement in no way judgmental, in no way derogatory. But in a group of this nature, there are a number of children who will never honestly be able to hear their parents say, "We can't afford that." Now, you know, someone might say, "Well, you buy Disney World for me." Well, we can't afford that. I'm not talking about that. I want to do this. I want to go there. I want to have this. I want this brand name. Parents may say, "I'm not going to pay for that." But very few are going to hear the words, kids will hear the words from parents, "I can't pay for that." God has blessed a number of faithful people with lots of money that's being used very well. But here's the thing. Your kids have got to know there's another side out there. Your kids have got to know that there are people in this world who can't just take off and go on a trip, who can't get the brand name that everybody else has. And even more than that, who may not be able to know exactly where the next meal is coming from. Our kids have got to understand that if we're going to train them to put others first. So never let your good efforts be done in the dark. I'm not saying for the glory of others, but for your children to see that, to help with it, to understand that the vast majority of children in this world are not blessed like children here are blessed. And I think what we'll see as we do that is the ability to raise a generation that will not question, that will not say, "Do I need to help?" No, the question will be is, "Where can I find somebody to help?" It's the Good Samaritan in real life. We see, we act, we go above and beyond. Now, why do we do this? Because that's exactly what God has done for us. There is a phrase that comes up in several Psalms. And that phrase is where the psalmist says to the Lord, "I am poor and needy." Psalmist wasn't necessarily talking about financial things. It was the realization that without God, we are in horrible, horrible shape. And when we can come to that understanding of what God has done for us, we then are not going to view it academic or obligatory to say, "What can I do to help others?" That'll be something we want to do. But it's coming to the point of understanding what it truly means to be poor in spirit. And so I encourage all of us that as we look for opportunities to help those who are physically in need, we do not shun those, and in fact, we take them very proactively. But it's first of all understanding what God has done for us, that God has given us a great opportunity for salvation. Let me just tell you, if you have not become a Christian, you're poor and needy right now. You are in a situation that you're lost, no hope of salvation whatsoever. But God has said, "I've given you a way." This morning, if you understand what it means to become a Christian, fully by the grace of God, to meet Him in the waters of baptism, and by your faith and trust in Him, to believe that when you go into that water, you will come out with your sins forgiven, God is ready to help generously because He's given everything He could for that.